Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi.
So it's customary for monks and nuns in the forest tradition to begin an evening Dhamma talk with, or a discourse with, oneself going for refuge to the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha. And for me, it's a really helpful reminder. And the reason why it's a helpful reminder is because it reminds me that this is an occasion to speak on Dhamma and to put the clarity and the knowing of the Buddha, the clarity of the teachings and the aspiration of the Sangha as the focus, and to allow whatever kind of personal views and opinions that I have to be secondary or aside. So my aspiration then would be to use this as an occasion to speak on Dhamma and for the benefit of awakening. And this invitation also is an invitation for everyone here to listen with an open heart and an interested ear and attentive. So even though at the moment I'm speaking and apparently no one else is speaking, ideally what's happening is there's actually a perfect dialogue taking place. And so what is really encouraged is that 90% of your attention is actually internal, so that you can feel the sense of resonance or dissonance that you might experience with whatever's being said. And then 10% is actually focused on the ideas, the sounds, the concepts that are coming through. And the reason why it's set up in that kind of a way is because when one's focused internally, then when the whole body kind of opens and relaxes and goes, aha, you know that there's something that's actually touching a truth that's inside. And when your whole body clenches and tightens up and says, then you know, well, it might be that that's personal resistance that needs to be further explored, but it actually might be that what you're hearing is that something has gone off the truth and that it's actually not something to pay attention to take on board. So I speak extemporaneously, I don't plan, and I am still a practitioner on the path, and as a result of these two things, there are times when what I say isn't helpful or isn't useful or isn't even in accordance with the Dhamma. And so in order to protect this situation so that what we do is maximize the potential for awakening, it requires each of us to do our utmost to be aligned with an intention of integrity and to be deeply listening inwardly to get a sense of the difference between that aha relaxation that is in congruence with truth and something that's tight or tense or contracting in resistance. And those resistance places needs to be explored, because sometimes it isn't just simply one's own personal resistance. Actually, one's connecting with something that one needs to be careful about taking on board. Yeah. So with that encouragement to listen, to take on board what's useful and to leave aside what isn't useful, and if I speak in a way that goes against your understanding of what the truth is, then to find some way of coming back to me, then I begin. Yeah. I'm just delighted to see everybody here, and you know, 3 days' notice or 2 days' notice or 1 day's notice, so just to have anybody come is really quite remarkable. So it's a sign of the kind of coherence and commitment of your group, and also the dedication of each of you who are very much interested in the Dhamma, and even though you don't know me, just interested to lend an ear and to hear and to see if there might be some value in spending some time together. And so I find it very heartening. So appreciate your effort and look forward to getting to know you more. This is the first time I think I've spent more than just a passing through journey in New Mexico. And so the land is new to me, and I can feel that you're in a different land, I'm in a different land, and the land affects the way we see and perceive and experience things. And today I was in a park this afternoon because there was an invitation if people wanted to have interviews that they could come and meet me there. And it was glorious to be in the park and to feel the cool of the breeze and just to be surrounded by grass and these magnificent trees. And I was there and I was reading some of anthology of the Buddha's teachings, and one of the metaphors that's used often is you know, that metaphor of coming out of the heat and into the cool of the shade. And on a day like today where it's reaching nearly 90, nearly 100, you know, the metaphor is not just an abstract metaphor, you know. You know, you're in the sun for just a few minutes and it feels like an anvil is hitting you on the head, you know. It's an kind of intensity that's uncomfortable, unpleasant. And so, you know, the cool of a shade and the kind of relaxation of what it is to come into the cool of a shade gives a perspective of what refuge is about. And, you know, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, what does that mean for us? So in a traditional Buddhist context, it's one of the defining characteristics of what one defines oneself as being a Buddhist. One takes refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. But coming from a culture where, for many people, their access was meditation rather than traditional forms and structures or monastic community, then it's an interesting contemplation, you know, what is refuge and how do we relate to it? And how is the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha something that we orient around and what does it mean for us? And it's an interesting exploration, you know, how do these things resonate? What do they mean for you? And how do you find a sense of well-being, nourishment, fulfillment, and depth in your own exploration of these? And so, you know, the Buddha has many different layers of meanings. And so in a traditional culture where people grew up with the stories of the Buddha and the Jataka tales, and the Buddha is very much a historical person that lived 2,500 years ago. And that historical person had a lot of important things to say. For people who are born into a contemporary culture where we don't have reference to stories or life experience or a way of celebrating a human being that lived 2,500 years ago, then the Buddha can take on the meaning of being the quality of presence, of knowing that we can open up to in every moment. And so, you know, this quality of being present and knowing things as they are is a quality of being awake. And that is one of the ways in which the awakened one is described as somebody who knows things as they are. So independent of whether or not we have a kind of a connection or affinity with a human being that lived 2,500 years ago and what that might mean for us or the implications of that, in the present moment there are qualities that we can pick up on, and hopefully they can have some sense of meaning or relevance in our life and in our practice. And likewise, when we look at the Dhamma, so the Dhamma here, we're in this exquisite shrine room, which is very classically assembled according to traditional Tibetan culture and custom. And traditionally, there are images of the Buddha and texts that are present and images of the teachers and offerings. And all of this is representative of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And so here you have the actual texts of what have been spoken as instruction representing here on the shrine room. So it's not abstract, they're here. And if we had the permission and the blessings to take one of these down and open it up, and we, if it was in English and we could read it or we knew Tibetan, we would see that these are actually the words and the instructions that were given. And so, you know, the teachings of the Buddha are represented by the things that he taught and embodied in the suttas, or in this case the sutras, that were then passed down over generations. And these form the kind of legacy that is part of the Buddha's teachings. And the teachings include an enormous variety of things. So they include learning how to relax and learning how to work with our anger and our fear and our greed, and learning how to cultivate loving kindness, and learning how to develop contentment, and learning how to live in healthy relationships in a family, and learning how, as a king or as an employer, how one needs to be in best relationship with the people around. And so they're not just abstract metaphysical things, they're practical down-to-earth things to deal with all the stuff that we have to deal with in our lives, and having a body and mind and the kinds of experiences that we have and the ways they go out of balance and how they can be brought back into balance, and issues of power and sexuality and fear and the normal human stuff that most of us know rather well. And that's what the suttas are comprised with. But in addition to being comprised with bringing balance to the conditions of our world and our life and our bodies and minds, they also give clarity about how we can stack the conditions in a way that are favorable, so that we are actually in a position to be able to understand and grasp that which is unconditioned, that which is not dependent on forms and not dependent on circumstances, which is not dependent on things going the way that we want, or not dependent on it not being hot. You know, it's okay for it to be hot. Can you imagine what it would be like living in New Mexico if it wasn't okay for it to be hot? You know, it would be a problem, because sometimes it's hot. So in addition to learning how to find the refuge of being in the coolness of the shade, there's also the learning how to be in the refuge of learning how to find peace when there isn't the shade of a tree. And these two things need to be held in balance. How is it and when is it that we need to find balance in the conditions of our experience? And when is it that we actually need to just rest in the clarity of knowing things as they are, without having the ability to control or change what's happening, and recognizing that some of the things that are happening are actually unpleasant? And then the third refuge is the refuge of Sangha. Now, in this room, we have lots of images of monks and a nun. And the Sangha has been traditionally defined as the fourfold Sangha, the Sangha of monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen, and all of us have an aspiration to practice. But I think that the Sangha is the aspiration to wake up out of suffering. And my own personal experience in speaking with different people of different religions is that it's not only limited to the Buddhist Sangha. It's the whole aspiration to wake up out of suffering and to enter into something which is ennobling, enlightening, and free. And I don't think the Buddhists have a monopoly on that. It's not my experience that we do, as much as sometimes I would like to be a part of the A-team. I can see that some of my brothers and sisters of other faiths and other religions also have a similar aspiration, even though they might express it in different language and use different concepts to define it. So this collective aspiration to awaken is something that I think we can share, and it's something that anybody who has walked the path from the beginning of time has also shared. And so we can plug ourselves into a kind of a stream of benevolence that's considerably bigger than the immediacy of our own personal life story and drama. And so one of the reasons why taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma, the Sangha, is considered an important thing to do as a part of beginning a retreat, beginning a ceremony, beginning a vasa, beginning part of the ordination, is because it aligns us with something that's immediately considerably larger than the limitations of our own particular story, conditioning, and drama, and puts us in the field of something which is immense, blessed, includes our personal experience, but is not limited to it. And for that reason, then, it has somehow a lot of importance. But in order for these things to have importance, they need to be alive. And how we make them alive is a personal journey that each one of us needs to explore. And how that looks like in terms of the kind of ceremony that we do, and how we brighten or bring these things alive, is something that different groups and different individuals need to explore. But nevertheless, taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha is presented as something of significance. Now, In the onset, I was asking for themes. And if I remember correctly, one theme was, you know, how do you deal with the fact that, you know, sometimes you can have an aspiration to let go of attachment, and it seems like come hell or high water, it doesn't let go. The other question was, is how does one actually enter into the flow of just trusting the practice without having to strive and to force and to make such a continuous effort? And then the other question was just another question about trusting life itself and its own unfolding. So let's see if there's some ability to weave these themes into the topic of refuges and where they lead to. Okay? Many of us, and I take myself in this example as well, really suffer from the difference between the way things are and the way things should be. So the way things are is what's actually happening in the present moment. It's the sum total of everything that's present, and it's the sum total of every reaction to everything that's present. And how we think it should be is often quite different. And so we can set our intention to go on a retreat or to spend the night in meditation under the full moon. And we can have this aspiration that it's going to be a night of energy, of clarity, of bliss, of non-attachment, of loving kindness, of equanimity, of of poise, of peacefulness, of serenity, and of rapture. And the reality is that it actually might be a little bit different than that. And the contrast between how it actually is and our imagined sense of how it should be is often where we find ourselves getting into trouble. So, we think we are supposed to let go of attachment because we've been told and because we agree that that's a good thing. But nevertheless, there can be attachment that arises. And the reality is that it takes its own time to let go. That it's not something that we have control over. So attachment arises dependent on conditions, and it releases when the conditions are no longer present. It's not actually something that we will, and therefore it's not something that we can get rid of through will. So we sit with an aspiration or intention to let go of attachment, which is a noble aspiration. But the reality is that attachment arises dependent on conditions. And when attachment is present, it will release. When the conditions are no longer present, it doesn't release because we think it should go. So we are then stuck sometimes with the conundrum of wanting it to go, it's not going, and then having to deal with the consequences of an attachment that we wish was rather not there. The problem is, coming back to the noble truths of what the problem is the suffering is not in what is arising. The problem is in the way that we're relating to it. So the problem is not in the attachment. The problem is in not wanting it to be there. So when we have this expectation that attachment should not be there, and attachment is there, then we suffer. But when we come back to the refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma and the Sangha as our refuge, then the refuge of knowing is able to open up to the truth of the way things are. And the truth of the way things are in our aspiration to awaken is able to accept that attachment is present. And I don't like it. In fact, I really don't like it. In fact, I'm totally fed up that it's here. But one is able to open up to the truth of that, then there's no suffering. So it's possible to be cold and to be miserable and not to suffer. Because one's not expecting it to be otherwise. When one expects to be cold and miserable and to be happy about it, and one's not, then that can sometimes cause problems. So the problem isn't so much in the fact that attachment arises. The problem is that our relationship with it is still something that we fundamentally feel is unacceptable. And that's where we have a difficulty. Now, it's useful to put oneself in challenging situations, and it's useful to see what arises when we're not in control, and it's useful to see what happens when we stretch ourselves a little bit. Because, you know, all kinds of things come up in terms of fears and anxieties and all the rest of that. And if the only practice that we have is a practice that's under control when the conditions are nice and when we feel comfortable and when everyone around us is telling us how much they love us and how much they appreciate our presence, it has a very limited range of application and usefulness, because when any of those conditions are not present, we feel really shaken up. And so one of the values of a monastic life is it's specifically designed to frustrate, to make you furious, to make you feel how much you want things, to see how little you can get what you want, in order that your attention is not focused on trying to manipulate the external circumstances, but recognizing that the real solution is in coming back to how we're relating to it. So a monastic life is absolutely designed, specifically, purpose-built, to make you angry, to make you irritated, to see how impatient you can be, and to see how often desire arises. Yeah. And it's done that way in order that eventually we can come back to the fact that our real deep satisfaction is not dependent on getting what we want and having conditions to be the way we think they should be. But it requires a profound recognition that it is in the relationship with the way things arise and what arises, rather than the conditions being what we want and getting rid of what we don't want. And that's one of the reasons why it's very powerful. I was a practitioner as a layperson for 10 years before I came to the monastery, and I thought I had a pretty hotshot practice. And I was rather surprised how much I suffered when I got to the monastery. And I think one of the sobering things that I realized was is that my hotshot practice had an awful lot of everything under control, under my terms kind of practice. And when I was in another circumstance where it wasn't under my control and according to my wishes, I was rather surprised by the level and magnitude of the amount of suffering that I experienced. And so it was from my own recognition of how much I was able not to be accurate about what was actually happening that I had an increased appreciation for some of the potency of why monastic life can be a useful tool for the occasions or circumstances or short periods of time for people for which it can be applicable. Yeah. Now, the topic of trust, trusting life, is in opposition to doubting life and doubting oneself, and it's something that we need to really learn how to do. And one of the things that I will forever be grateful to Ajahn Sumedho for, forever, is his repeated encouragement for me to trust myself. And I remember that when I was considering, you know, I had told him in the year 98 that I was thinking about wandering around the planet for a few years and pulling myself back from the community and just living, you know, basically as an alms mendicant on faith. But I felt deeply conflicted because the sisters were still kind of needing a lot of support, and I was senior and I had some things to offer, and I felt conflicted in my loyalties. And he said to me, "Sister," he said, "how many years have you been here?" And I said, 9. He said, "You have got to trust yourself. You've given enough. You've got to trust yourself, and you're going to have to find your own way." And he said to me that, I don't know how many times I met him and talked to him about it, and he really strongly encouraged me to trust myself. And it was torturous because I felt so conflicted between the variety of different loyalties that I had. But it was clear that what I was doing was something that I needed to do for a whole variety of reasons, and that I was going to have to survive the conflict of loyalties that I was experiencing and just move forward in this movement into faith that took me into uncharted territories. And so, you know, what does it mean to trust yourself? You know, particularly when we don't take ourselves to be our sensations and our moods and our feelings and our emotions and our perceptions. Yeah. So what do we trust if that's not what we're trusting? And this is not actually a simple question to answer, because I can't give you a formula for it. All I know is that when we begin to trust our intuitive understanding of things, then we are able to be able to discern between what kind of sensations and perceptions and thoughts and feelings and moods arising are ones that are important to listen to and ones that are important not to believe in. And this is a discerning process that comes out of experience. It's not something there's any formulaic answer to, other than being willing to make mistakes, to get it wrong, to see the consequence of that, not in order that we trust ourselves less, but in order that we begin to trust ourselves more. So when we learn to start trusting ourselves, we can learn to see that there's a difference between the voices of wisdom which are operating and the voices of fear and confusion and self-criticism and self-judgment which are operating. When we begin to trust our own intuition, we begin to see how when we follow our intuition, and there's wholesome results. When we don't follow our intuition, there's unwholesome results. So we need to learn how to begin to tune into almost a different sense of ourselves and ones that many of us are not that familiar with in order to get a feeling for what that's about. Now, the topic of effort. The topic of effort is an important topic because it comes up repeatedly, again and again and again and again and again. It's in the beginning, it's in the middle, and it's in the end. And when we have the right relationship with effort, there is something entirely different that's happening when we don't have the right relationship with effort. I came from... I don't know how I got this, but I started meditating when I was 17, and I had this sense that if I just tried hard enough, then I would be able to become enlightened. And when I became enlightened, then I was quite convinced that everyone would love me and I'd have no more problems. And so I thought, if I just try hard enough and do it long enough, then all my problems would go away and everyone would love me, and that would be the answer to everything. And you know, it's a little bit like a 3-year-old kind of version of waking up, you know, something very young and naive, and also pointing a lot to quite a lot of personal work that I needed to attend to that I wasn't very aware of. But these things all ripened in their own time, and sooner or later I was able to see some of the fallacies of my views and begin to attend to some of the personal pain from which these views were coming from and open that stuff up. So there's a sense that, in a classical perspective, samsara is a dangerous and very bad place. And if you are not careful, you are going to be perpetually cycling in this world of misery. And so it's really important to get out. And to get out requires the right relationship with sense restraint and morality and meditation and effort. And if one does the right things and the right ingredients according to the right recipe, then one attains a state that seals one's possibility of returning to these bad things happening. And that's a good thing to strive for. And there is some considerable value in the classical view of looking at things in terms of understanding the enormousness of suffering that is present in this world, the unpredictability of our death, the fact that we have no guarantee of what happens next, the fact that there are all kinds of people in all kinds of situations whose states of deprivation is so extraordinary, it's actually quite difficult to practice within. These are not insignificant or trivial contemplations. They're not irrelevant contemplations. They're important contemplations. But they're important contemplations in order to bring forward the motivation to practice. Okay? when there's no motivation to practice, it's important to see that sometimes contemplating in this way brings forward an interest to recognize that however much good fortune that we have, it's not something that is reliable. And that the spectrum of what's possible next is actually quite extraordinary to contemplate. I mean, even if we think of what would happen if we walked out of this room and we were in a car accident, you know? I read a book and I saw a movie this year called The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. And it was about a high-powered journalist who was driving his fancy car and had a stroke, and was in this condition called locked-in syndrome, where the only thing he had control over was one eyelid. That was it. So he could feel, he could think, he could perceive, but the only control he had over any part of his body was one eyelid. And so it took exceptionally compassionate and a very gifted physical therapist quite a process to learn a communication system that would be able to enable him to be able to communicate, because it had to go through the whole alphabet and he would blink twice if it was the right letter. Okay? So to be able to spell one word required going through this series of letters to get to the right word and blink. And so here he was, an intelligent, capable, wealthy, prestigious, high-powered person 1 minute, and the next minute, that was his condition. And who of us can say with absolute certainty that we are not going to have to experience something like that? We don't know, you know. We just absolutely do not know what's in store. So this encouragement to practice and this encouragement to make practice a real priority comes from a genuine understanding of the fragility of life, the uncertainty of life, and the uncertainty with which we have no idea how long our fortunate circumstances are going to last. We just absolutely have no idea. None of us do. Okay? And so if we think, well, you know, practice a little bit here, a little bit there, an hour here, maybe next month or next year, a little bit there. It's not like there's anything bad with that, but it doesn't begin to turn around some of our perpetual habits of looking at things which don't see clearly. And so it's for these reasons that these classical teachings around the urgency, the necessity, the importance, and the effort are given, encouraged, and reiterated. What can happen is that some of us, I took it on board, and I thought, the harder I practice, the better. The more effort I make, the better. The more I strive, the better. And then what one realizes is that one strives and strives and strives and strives and strives, and it's miserable a sin, and one cannot figure out why. And then one has to realize that it's the striving itself which is causing part of the problem. Because striving itself is an out-of-balance energy. And so the energy to practice itself needs to come into balance, and what then needs to happen is that one begins to need to understand that the practice isn't only about getting there, but about arriving here. And the difference in change of values, of orientation, of view, is something that for me was a radical shift in my practice. Of what happens when I stop trying to get there? And what happens if I try to open my heart as fully as possible and respectfully and loving as possible to being here? What does that look like? How do I experience that? And what are the consequences and the result? And what I find is a radical shift. Because I'm not interested in getting anywhere. But I'm also not oblivious to the fact of that there are times when I need to put an effort. So, you know, when my mind gets all scrambled up into concerns or worries, or I've been spending 8 hours on the computer and my brain is fried, and I sit down and it's, you know, I realize that if I try and sit like that, it's just going to be like this. But if I made an effort to allow some of my own internal system to come into balance, to take time to have my feet connecting with the earth, to allow my body to relax, then when I sit, it's a sitting in a peaceful place rather than sitting in a jangled or frazzled place. So the effort to be effortless also requires the discernment of when skillful application of effort is needed. Because it is very rare to know a person who is so advanced or evolved or stable in their practice that effort is no longer needed. And so, in addition to beginning to learn how to contemplate where suffering is absent, to begin to learn how to be effortless in one's effort, one also needs to learn how to see how it's not just floating on a cloud. It's also about being discerning about what's actually happening and how am I relating to it. And so it goes back to the refuge in Dhamma. What's actually happening and how am I actually relating to it? Because we can have an idea that what I'm doing now is effortless effort. That's the trip. That's the thing. That's the plan. Yeah. And we can get ourselves tangled up into an absolute pretzel because what's needed is actually a little application of effort. And so we can take anything, absolutely anything. Ignorance is ingenious at co-opting anything for its own purposes. And so what is needed is to develop the discernment to be able to see what is actually something which is conducive to balance and to health and to well-being and what is not. And so for me, it's helpful to have signposts. Am I within or without the precepts? Is my body relaxed or am I tense? Is there a sense of struggle or is there a sense of ease and well-being with what's happening? If I'm struggling, where's the struggle? Is the struggle because I'm resisting what's happening? Is the struggle because I don't think I should be experiencing what's happening? What is the struggle? And so when there's a struggle, there needs to be an honest application of discernment. Where is the struggle coming from? And then a clarity about, is effortless effort what's needed now? Or do I actually need to make an effort to relax? There are times when I need to relax. So we need to pick up practices and understand that they are contextual. And understand that what might be a general view or a general or direction that we're going to in an instant might change, and we might need to make slight adjustments in order to have some sense of rebalancing in order that that will have some application later. Now, I don't know about you, but I still, some things knock me, and I end up in some kind of a regressed space, so maybe I'm 2 or 3 or 4, yeah? If I have the view that I am supposed to be whatever age I am now, and that's the way that I am, then I completely miss what's happened, and the way I relate to that situation is utterly inappropriate. And so what's needed is a moment-by-moment flexibility that has no preconceived notions about how it's supposed to be and is utterly responsive and sensitive to what's actually happening right now. Not how it's supposed to be, not how I think it's supposed to be, not how it should be, but what is actually happening right now? And how am I relating to that? And it's humbling. And sometimes it's humiliating. But it is what it is. And what is worthy of our attention. And what is worthy of our attention gives us the capacity to respond in a way that's based on compassion and wisdom rather than on view and opinion and idea. So practice is alive. The present moment is alive. And our capacity to know things as they are, our capacity to rest in the awareness of things as they are, the Buddha knowing the Dhamma, and our aspiration to wake up out of suffering is really the sum total of our practice. It's not trivial. Refuge is not trivial. So how do you experience refuge? What knocks you out? How do you establish balance when you get knocked out? Important things to consider. Yeah. So I will stop now for this bit and change the format, open the floor and invite comments, questions, discussion, participation.